Let's start with our motivation. And some days we feel very happy, and some days we don't. Sometimes when we're very happy, we forget to practice the Dharma because, wow, samsara is really great. And then sometimes when we're unhappy, we also don't practice the Dharma because we get stuck in our unhappiness. So what we have to learn is the ability to have a Dharma perspective no matter what our circumstances are and no matter what mood we're in. So when we're feeling happy, recognizing it's the result of good karma, and so wanting to create more, and also recognizing that the happiness is transient. It's not going to fulfill us forever and ever, and so keeping on practicing. And then when we feel miserable, also not getting disheartened and failing to practice, but remembering that that state too is changing, that state too is a result of our own karma. And if we don't like that experience, then we need to create the causes to have different kinds of experiences. And so in that way, we also keep practicing. So either way, we remember that cyclic existence is unsatisfactory for ourselves and for everybody else. And so we generate the wish to develop all of our spiritual potential to its utmost, not only to free ourselves and bring happiness to ourselves, but especially to all other living beings. So take a moment and generate that motivation. Somebody wrote in a question and said something to the effect of, I'm having a big problem with my skepticism about, you know, what you're teaching about all these bodhisattva things. And the person didn't indicate exactly what they were having skepticism with or what they were, you know, their doubt was arising towards. They just were saying that they were being very skeptical. So I was thinking, now what could we be skeptical of regarding the bodhisattvas, you know? Is it that we're reading here that bodhisattvas can be born as kings in the god realms? Does that make us skeptical? Yeah? Can you be born in a god realm?
I guess so.
In Florida, I know. What is that?
Yeah, in Florida, the God realm in Florida.
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, so why can't a bodhisattva be born in a God realm for the benefit of others? Yeah?
They won't be able to do much, will they?
Huh?
Will they be able to do very much?
Well, the idea is that if you have a position of power in samsara, then you can do more to benefit others. It's kind of like in our society, if you're in a position of power and you're a bodhisattva, you can do so much good for sentient beings. I mean, imagine if the president of the U.S. were a bodhisattva. Do you think a bodhisattva can be born as the president of the U.S.?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
We have that.
Yeah?
But the question was more like, when that arises in the mind, like, oh, a trillion, a billion, What do you apply?
Okay, so for maybe the doubt is arising in terms of those 12 sets of qualities, and
things that sound like super.
Okay. Well, okay, so when you hear a trillion, just the numbers, you're not even applying it to anything.
No.
You're just saying the numbers.
It's
give me something specific.
Okay, it's more like, this is really embarrassing, it's one question, but it's like, it starts sounding like Superman and Wonder Woman and...
Okay, but give me something specific that you doubt can happen.
I doubt that I can achieve this state. I think that's what I'm dealing with.
Okay, that you doubt that you can achieve this state. Do you think other people can achieve this state? Do you think there are fully enlightened Buddhas?
Yeah, somewhere, someplace. It feels far, far away.
Okay. If you look at it, the nature of the mind is that it can reflect objects and it can engage with objects. So why can't it engage with different things? Well, sometimes, like my mind, there's physical objects. I can't see what's up. Physical obstructions. I can't see what's on the other side of the wall. Does that mean that there's nothing on the other side of the wall? No. Okay. It just means that there's a barrier to my perceiving it. Okay. When I can't remember where I put something... Yeah. Does that mean that that object doesn't exist, or that that object isn't anywhere, or does it just mean that my mind cannot remember where I put something?
Right. So it's ignorance.
So that the problems with my mind,
right.
A barrier in my mind, I can't remember where I put something,
right.
Even yesterday,
right.
Sometimes even 5 minutes ago. Okay. Does that mean that that object doesn't exist? No. It just means there's obstruction in my mind to remembering, to perceiving, you know, where that object is.
And how do we deal with the obstruction in the mind?
Okay. How do we deal with the obstructions in the mind? We apply the antidotes. Okay. So for attachment, you remember impermanence. For anger, you practice patience and loving kindness. For ignorance, you meditate on dependent arising. Okay, so you apply the antidotes. If the nature of the mind is to reflect things, and that's its very nature, and it can't reflect things sometimes because of physical objects, obstacles, and sometimes because of mental obstacles, when you remove the physical obstacles, you can see what's there. If you take the wall away, I can see what's on the other side. If we take the obstacles that are obscuring my mind away, can I see things that I can't see now?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so you take the mental obstacles away, then your mind can see things. Now your mind goes, but how can that happen to me? Now, think of a little baby, okay? Imagine there's a little baby in the room, yeah? And, I mean, what's going on in that baby's mind? They're crying, they're peeing, they can't tell who's who, they don't know anything, they can't speak, they can't gesticulate. They're completely, you know, just inept, you know? Now, when you look at that baby, do you think that baby can grow up and become a rocket scientist?
Mm-hmm.
Or an electrician? Or a car mechanic? Or a historian? Yes, you look at that baby and you think, oh, that baby can grow up to be like that. But when you look just at what that baby is now, doesn't it seem almost impossible that that baby could grow up to have all that kind of knowledge and talents and abilities? When you just look at the state of the baby's mind in this very moment, it's so limited. And you think, how can that baby grow up and know how to even build a house. It seems absolutely impossible if you just look at that baby's state of mind. And yet we know babies can grow up and learn how to build houses and learn how to plumb and learn all these things. Okay? So just because the mind is limited right now doesn't mean it's always going to be. Yeah? How come that baby can grow up and learn calculus? Because it has potential. Because the nature of the mind is able to reflect and know objects, because that baby has some intelligence. And it has a lot of other mental factors that can be developed. And when those mental factors are developed, the baby can, you know, play the violin and do so many things. Well, how about spiritually? You know, right now we're kind of like babies, aren't we? Mm-hmm. We can't do very much. But if the nature of our mind is such that these obstacles can be cleared away, then can't we too grow up and be things that we can't even dream of being right now? I mean, does that baby even have the thought, I could be a musician? The baby doesn't even have the thought. Doesn't even have the vocabulary, doesn't even have the language or the conceptual ability. And yet it has that potential. So in the same way, you know, we may not have any idea. You know, when we hear about the qualities of a Buddha, it seems so far out. But can't we, you know, grow up and become like that if we have the basic raw material there? Yeah, we can. So it's not impossible. Yeah. So, you know, when we have this skeptical mind, do you remember when, who was it who landed on the moon? John Glenn. Okay.
Neil Armstrong.
Neil Armstrong? He was the first one? Oh, yeah, he rotated. Neil Armstrong. Okay, he landed on the moon. Okay. When they went to tell people in tribal areas who had no communication with the outside world that somebody had landed on the moon, these people said, you're nuts, it's impossible. What are you talking about, a human being going on the moon? That is totally impossible. Okay? If you had told, you know, our great-great-grandparents that there would be a man on the moon, do you think they could have believed it? No. Yeah, the people have been talking a lot recently about Michelle Obama's ancestry. Do you think if they had told one of her ancestors who was a slave that their great-great-great-great-granddaughter would be the first lady, that they would have believed it? No. Okay, so our mind is so limited in what we can believe. Yeah, but you know, if we kind of stretch our mind and start to have a big mind, you know, we can see that there's a lot of things that are possible that we had never even dreamt of before. Mm-hmm. Yeah?
When you stretch your mind, does it make it easier for those things to happen?
When you stretch your mind, does it make it easier? Yes. Yeah, because if you don't believe, it's like the little boy Tyrone I keep telling you about. He didn't believe he could learn to read, so he couldn't learn to read. Okay, so if we don't believe that we can get rid of our anger, we're never going to get rid of our anger. Yeah, why? Because we won't make the effort. Because if we don't believe something's possible, we're not going to make the effort to make it happen. And then definitely it's not going to happen, is it? Okay. Yeah.
Sometimes my mind goes to a lot of doubt about, like, just in general, like, purpose of hearing teachings that are this particular kind. Mm. I just sort of think, like, you know, if I were practicing subduing my anger, or if I were, you know, it's hard for me to kind of feel like see the purpose in knowing this kind of thing.
Okay. So sometimes your doubt comes is you don't understand the purpose in knowing this stuff.
Right.
Because it seems like if you were actively doing something to change your mind, that would be much more useful.
Yeah, and like hearing the qualities of a bodhisattva, it's like, sure, maybe, you know, but like I don't see, it doesn't necessarily make me change my desire to become a bodhisattva, you know, like mm-hmm. I have a strong desire to become like that,
mm-hmm.
but hearing about these things doesn't necessarily...
Okay, so you have a strong desire to be of benefit to sentient beings.
Right.
But hearing about these extraordinary qualities of the bodhisattva doesn't help that desire
right.
increase. Okay, now, if, let's say, you, just as you are right now, you know, you have this benefit to benefit sentient beings, and you become a bodhisattva. Okay, so what are you going to be capable of doing to benefit sentient beings that you aren't capable of doing right now?
A lot.
Like what?
Maybe not being at the will of my own ego, or, you know, something like that, or like not giving into anger as easily, or understanding better so mm-hmm. that I can teach people about it or something.
Okay. Should be able to benefit sentient beings by having more control of your own mind so you don't subject them to your negative emotions,
yeah.
and by teaching them the way to conquer their own harmful emotions. Okay. Who are you going to be able to teach?
Anyone.
Yeah, but I mean, it's going to have to be the people
right.
that kind of on this planet.
Maybe like my parents.
Yeah, okay, so maybe your parents. You know, maybe some people, you go to a city and there's, you know, 25 people who come and listen to you. Yeah, or you go somewhere else and there's 5 people who listen to you. But in trying to decide where to go, you don't really know who's going to be a receptive audience and who isn't. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you go to places and nobody shows up. Mm-hmm. Yeah, or you go to places and they all fall asleep when you're trying to benefit them. Or you go somewhere and they say, why are you telling me this? Doesn't make any sense. You know, I can't lessen my anger. What are you talking about? I was born angry. So then you start to feel like, boy, I can't really benefit very many people, can I? Now, what would happen if you had the ability to know what people were like on the inside and you could know who would be receptive to what you were saying and who wouldn't be receptive? That would be a nice quality, right? Because then you could know if you're going to get on a plane and travel somewhere, where you're going to, somebody's going to show up and where they're going to be able to listen to teachings and they're not going to fall asleep and they're not going to say, ooh, what are you talking about? Okay, so it would be nice to have that ability to know who's receptive and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And even, so that's an ability a bodhisattva has. They can know who's receptive and who's not.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Even if you go somewhere as an ordinary you, you know, are you going to be fully confident of how you explain something to someone else? Because people have so many dispositions and tendencies, and you may want to explain to them how to deal with their anger, but... You know, they're a person who likes to joke, and so you explain it in a serious way, and it doesn't get through. Or they're a person who's serious, and you joke, so it doesn't get through. But wouldn't it be nice to have the ability to know what kind of personalities people had?
Mm-hmm.
So you would know how to explain to them how to work with their anger. That would be a really good skill, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's the kind of skill a bodhisattva has that you don't have at the moment.
Right. But I still don't understand how, like, learning about it versus having it, you know? Like,
okay. Oh, because when... we learn about it, it gives us a vision of what we can become. Because otherwise, if I say to you, you know, okay, want to become a bodhisattva, then you're going to go, but I'm still going to be me with all my same limitations. How am I going to really be able to benefit anybody? Why should I work so hard to do that? You know, I can benefit people now. Why should I do all these practices to become a bodhisattva? Because I don't have any special ability to benefit anybody. Whereas if you learn about these qualities and you think, oh, I can develop those, and that will really enhance my ability to be a benefit to others, then it gives you a better idea of what you can become. You know, it's like that little baby. If the little baby never heard about the qualities of an electrician, are they going to want to grow up and become an electrician? No. Because they don't even know what an electrician does. They don't even see the advantage. They don't know. Oh, an electrician understands how electricity works, and they can make these wires and make lights come on and, you know, toilets flush and do all these kinds of magical things. Yeah, isn't it? You know, the electrician can wire a whole movie theater, and then you have things showing on a screen in front of you, and they can make a whole water system work by pumping the water up. But if you never heard about the qualities of an electrician, you wouldn't even know that you could become that. Yeah, so you'd never have the thought. So then, you know, you'd never learn anything about electricity, and then you'd be like me. You know, all I can do is change a light bulb if I'm lucky. Yeah? So when you learn about things that you can become, it gives you a vision, and then you want to make effort to become that way. Whereas if you don't know about it, then you don't even think about it. It doesn't even enter the mind. Yeah? So, you know, what? This is why we're learning about things that seem quite amazing to us, so that we'll get this idea of, oh, maybe I have that potential. There's that ability. I want to develop that ability. Yeah?
I guess I'm sort of confused. Like, you know, when you think about a baby developing that qualities of becoming an electrician, mm-hmm. it's like they have some choice to know, like, okay, well, if I know that if I want to become an electrician, I have to do this.
Mm-hmm.
So if I want to benefit people by becoming a librarian, I do this.
Mm-hmm.
Or I want to do this other thing, I do this.
Mm-hmm.
But if you practice Buddhism, or you practice the Bodhisattva path, it's not like you're choosing different things, you know.
Well, there are different spiritual goals. If you're a hearer, you could choose your own awakening, you know, your own personal liberation. And I don't need to develop all those qualities. I'll just get liberated myself. Yeah, so you have a choice about what you want to, what talents you want to develop in yourself, and what your aim is. Somebody may think, oh, I just want to develop samadhi, and I'll hang out in the form of formless realms. It's really blissful there. You're born there for a really long time. That sounds good enough to me. I don't really want anything more. So then you practice for that. You get born there. It's kind of it's blissful for a while, and then the karma runs out, and you're back where you started. Or you never hear about a bodhisattva, so you never think of becoming one. So you liberate yourself, and you stay in your own meditative equipoise on emptiness. And meanwhile, your parents are still dying and getting reborn and dying and getting reborn and dying and getting reborn. And you don't even know that there's anything you can do to benefit them. Okay? So, you know, we have a choice of what spiritual capabilities we develop. And so the more we know about what options there are, the more we can really think of, well, what do I want to develop according to what my aspiration is? And how can I really expand my aspiration so it's not just about me, but really, you know, encompasses other living beings? Okay.
There's a comment online from John Hopper. He says, the more I hear, especially from teachers that have spoken the absolute truth and things that I can verify, the more I think that anything is possible, including me flying or seeing through walls. Just my thought on this.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So John is saying that the more he hears teachings from people who have already taught him something that he can verify from his own experience, the more he's willing to give some slack and say, well, this, what this person's saying sounds fantastic, but it might be true. I mean, if you think about it, you know, 10 years ago, if somebody told you that it was possible to eliminate your anger completely, would you believe them? No. Do you now believe it's possible to eliminate your anger completely? Yeah. Even though you haven't done it, you can see that by practicing what you've been practicing so far, that your mind's gotten better.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, the other thing I appreciate about these teachings is that it shows me how to get from here, this solid thing, to there. And without these teachings, I just had this vague idea of what a Buddha is.
Mm-hmm.
And that someone who just has the luck of the draw, you know,
yeah,
gets to that state, or was born that way. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it really gives you a much more detailed description of what's possible, so that you actually think that there's a method to get there, instead of, well, you know, maybe I'll get born as a Buddha if I'm lucky or something, you know, which is not going to happen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
Especially the analogy of the baby is very helpful for me to keep thinking about.
Yeah.
What a baby's capable of.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, babies grow up and become geniuses and professors.
Yeah.
And it's a really good analogy for me to think about.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah. So it's just the thing of, you know, expanding our mind a little bit. I mean, just so many things in our life that we're doing, that we're capable of doing now, did you even think 10 years ago you would be capable of doing? You know, and these are just even small things.
Yeah, I never thought I'd be able to sit for an hour. Never. Just
yeah.
No way.
Right. 10 yeah. years ago, you could never sit for an hour. Can you now?
Yeah.
Yes. You know, when you were 3 years old, did you ever imagine that you could sculpt something beautiful? No. Now you can.
Just the snakes is what I thought.
Yeah, right. The Play-Doh. Yeah, rolling it. Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, but when you were little, somebody showed you a book with sculpture in it and all sorts of other things. So even though you couldn't make those things when you were 3 years old, you got some idea of, oh, wow, look, maybe I can one day be able to make things like that. And then you went about learning the skills so that you could actually do it. Yeah. And so, especially now, you know, if we really think, how much can I benefit somebody? Well, you know, we can benefit people to some extent. But, you know, our ability to benefit is really quite limited now. Yeah, it's really quite limited. So if we could remove some of those obstacles to our being able to be a benefit, wouldn't that be nice? You know, and if some of those obstacles are internal obstacles, you know, that I can't see other people's, you know, aptitude and predispositions, I don't know what they're interested in, I don't know the best way to talk to them, to make them understand, I don't know if they're intelligent, and, you know, what should I use logic, should I use analogies, you know, we don't know. So to be able to have that ability would really increase. Yeah? And especially knowing the nature of reality, that would be able to really increase our ability to help, wouldn't it? Yeah? Okay, so we're learning about all these things so that we can follow that path and increase our abilities.
I think also this text, this teaching, flies in the face of the general Western culture mind that says that things are quick and easy and fast to get to.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I found that before you gave these teachings, I mean, I've been saying bodhisattvas in my prayers and aspirations for years, and I think I had some very romantic notion that, well, they were a little bit different from me, and they had a few different powers, and they were somewhere close by, but laying it out to see the expansiveness and the vastness and the trajectory that they are on and that I'm thinking, you know, that I'm on also, it put me much more into it checked my reality, and surprisingly, it really inspired me. It took a lot of pressure off of my mind.
Mm.
Thinking that, you know, I'm learning about how vast the mind of a bodhisattva is, even on the path of accumulation, just with the spontaneous bodhicitta, how vast it is. And what I'm doing here is creating the causes.
Mm-hmm.
And that it has really inspired me that I'm starting, I'm on that path, that I'm not like separate from it.
Mm-hmm.
And that teaching that you had given that said, you know, Buddhists don't live in some universe. They don't come out of nothing. They've started right where we are. You know, it's not like we're on a different trajectory than they are.
Mm-hmm.
So listening to this, I'm starting to put the pieces of where I am and how I'm creating the causes and conditions to be. I'm on the same line.
Yeah.
Like I'm on some other line.
Yeah.
And that was the part that was very inspiring.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, so you're beginning to see that there's an actual path of steps of things to develop, that it's not just I'm here and Buddha's way up there and there's no way for me to become a Buddha. Yeah, but there's an actual path of qualities to develop, and there's teachings that tell you how to develop those qualities.
And it's not a different path than the one that I am on.
Yeah. Yeah, so you're on that path that's going to where the Buddha's gone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Could you talk about fortitude?
What about fortitude?
How we develop fortitude?
How
that it stays in and go for it.
Yeah. You know, I think you develop fortitude a lot through making mistakes and realizing our mistakes don't work.
I'm going to have
Yeah, you will. Yeah, because you get angry and then you see that was useless. So I better have some fortitude when people criticize me because I just spent, you know, 2 weeks being really ticked off about something and it was a total misunderstanding and a waste of time. So next time I'm going to, you know, develop some fortitude to start with. Or, you know, learning this, understanding this part of the text is really difficult. You know, or meditating on emptiness is really challenging. But, you know, it's going to go somewhere good. So I develop fortitude and, you know, I can stick with it. Yeah, we've got to be able to stick with things and not just throw up our hands and say, you know, what to do? I'm going to sit and, you know, get depressed and discouraged and suck my thumb and whine. Yeah. That's it.
I think that was 6 or 8.
Yeah.
My grandmother put some gloves and she sat in front of everybody and she taped the gloves and it was gloves after that.
Right. Okay. Are you ready to hear about the seventh Bhumi Bodhisattva?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Okay, so the seventh ground is called the Gone Afar, and its explanation also has 4 parts. So the first is the mode of achieving qualities on the seventh ground. So on this ground, one achieves the 12 sets of good qualities that we talked about before, 110,000 trillion fold. So that's 1 quadrillion. Okay? So if you think that it's possible to have that quality one time, then why not 100 times? Then why not 1,000 times? Then why not 1 trillion or a quadrillion? Yeah?
It's just multiplication.
Yeah? It's like if you can make $1, can't you eventually make $10 or $100? Yeah. Okay, then the second is the mode of achieving majesty of power on the seventh ground. So having seen the signs of being able to abandon simultaneously the three cycles of the small afflictive obscurations or obstructions to be abandoned by a path of meditation due to having accumulated the collection of merit and subsequent attainment, one sets in meditative equipoise on emptiness. Thereby, one meditative consciousness becomes an actual antidote to all three of those obstructions, and one is able to move to the eighth ground. Okay, so you're on the seventh ground. You collect merit, you know, so you're really enriching your mind with merit, and you're doing meditation on emptiness, and in your meditation on emptiness, you feel the power of your meditation is increasing. And, you know, you think, oh, you know, soon, you're not thinking this in your meditation, but you kind of know, soon I'll be able to eliminate the three kinds of small afflictions, the big, small, medium, small, and small, small afflictions. Okay, to be abandoned on the path of meditation. And so when you feel that that's strong enough, then you know, really sit and meditate on emptiness. Your mind goes in that meditation session directly into an uninterrupted path of the eighth bhumi, the lower uninterrupted path of the eighth bhumi. That is, that, you know, abandons those, the three small afflictions. Yeah, and then that from there you go on to the liberated path, which has completely abandoned them so that they can't return. And then in that way you're on the eighth bhumi. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then the third outline was the mode of surpassing practice of a perfection on the seventh ground. So usually we hear just about the six perfections, but there's also 10 perfections, and they say that the last four can be included in the perfection of wisdom, in the sixth one. But here, because there's 10 grounds, they're matching each ground with one of the perfections, that because you develop it to a surpassing level on that ground. So through the force of having achieved a greatly surpassing practice of the perfection of wisdom, that was on the sixth ground, one has the capacity manifestly both to enter into and to arise from in one shortest moment that uncommon absorption of cessation which was attained earlier on the sixth ground. Okay, so remember we were saying on the sixth ground one can obtain this uncommon absorption of cessation, that the common absorption of cessation is just like a cessation of the coarse mental functioning. But then bodhisattvas within that coarse cessation meditate on emptiness. That's the uncommon absorption of cessation. Okay, and here, on the seventh ground, you can go into that absorption of cessation and come out of it in the shortest moment. Okay? So your ability to concentrate and to control your mind is really pretty amazing. Because that absorption is difficult to start with, but then being able to go in and out of it very quickly is very, very difficult. Okay, and so when you can do this, then whereby one outshines hearers and solitary realizers also by power of intelligence. Okay, so because one's intelligence, one's wisdom is so strong that you can meditate in, you know, this uncommon absorption of cessation and go in and out of it so quickly, you can meditate on emptiness in it and go in and out of it so quickly, then you're the power of your mind is and the power of your wisdom is much greater than that of a here and solitary realizer. Also, having cultivated vastly a joy which is free from conceit. Wouldn't that be nice? A joy that is free from conceit. Usually, we're happy about something and we're pretty conceited. Look what I got. Look what I can do. Look what people said about me. Look what I have. Yeah, we're joyful and we're pretty conceited about what we're joyful about. But here, which is a total setup to fall flat on our face, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. As soon as you're conceited, it's, you know what's going to happen next. Plunk. Okay. So, having cultivated vastly a joy which is free from conceit, with respect to all the virtuous roots of oneself and others, in terms of the six perfections, giving and so forth, one achieves a surpassing practice of the perfection of method or skillful means, which increases that joy higher and higher. Okay, so what this means is that, we've been practicing rejoicing at the virtue of ourself and others for a long time. Okay, and specifically the virtues of ourself and others that we've accumulated by means of the six far-reaching practices. Yeah, giving and so forth. And now we're able to have a joy which is free from conceit when we rejoice at all these virtues of the six far-reaching practices that we and other people have done. So when we have that kind of ability, yeah, then we achieve a surpassing practice of method, or another translation for method is skillful means. Okay, and with that skillful means of being able to rejoice in that way, yeah, that increases your joy, so it becomes greater and greater. Yeah, so this bodhisattva has the opposite, the mind that's opposite to the 6 o'clock news mind. Okay, the 6 o'clock news is, oh, this is wrong, and oh, that's wrong, and I'm so angry about what this one does, and I'm so angry about what that one does, and this world is totally corrupt, and it's so hopeless, and I'm helpless to do anything about it. That's the 6 o'clock news mind, right? And we're addicted to watching the 6 o'clock news and generating that mind. This mind is the total opposite. It looks, it sees all the goodness in the world, especially the goodness of the bodhisattvas who are practicing, doing the six far-reaching practices, all throughout the universe. You could see all these bodhisattvas. And even us, just kind of toddling along, doing our best, trying to create merit. And this bodhisattva just says, I'm so happy. This is fantastic. Look at what all these beings are doing. Yeah. Now that's a very, very, and they don't feel conceited about it at all, because they're also rejoicing in their own merit. And they're not saying, oh, look at me, I eliminated the smallest affliction, afflictive obscuration. Aren't I great? I'm so joyful. It's like, we go, oh, I got my BA. Look, aren't I good? Oh, I got my MA, look at this thing, and I'm dressed up in a special way, aren't I good? Yeah? And this bodhisattva has done things so much better than that. And they're not all conceited about it. Yeah?
The word surpassing, what?
It means that it's, you're surpassing the level, your ability to do this in all the previous levels. Okay, so it's surpassing in that it's greater than your ability, of your skillful means on the sixth ground and everything you've done previously. If you've really taken a big step forward in skillful means. Okay, so skillful means are very important for achieving our own purposes as well as others' purposes. And skillful means also indicate the way that Buddhas and Bodhisattvas adapt the teachings and adapt their own behavior so that they can communicate in the most effective way to sentient beings, given sentient beings' specific capacities and specific needs. Okay? So, you know, one skillful means is if you're a Bodhisattva, you can talk in English to English speakers. Yeah? You, if you want to be a Bodhisattva and go benefit people in China, what can you do now? Yeah? Yeah, but if you're a Bodhisattva, then you can get these languages like this and then just go off and benefit all these people. Okay? Okay, so the skillful means like applies to a Bodhisattva's capability to be of benefit. They also apply to a Bodhisattva's ability to attain very deep states of concentration, because that's what the seventh grounder can do. And they don't get waylaid by attachment to being born in the form or formless realms when they do these deep states of concentration, because long ago they've generated renunciation of cyclic existence. And they also are very skilled in their ability to know, to realize emptiness without abandoning the sentient beings who are empty. You know, because sometimes when we hear about, oh, sentient beings lack inherent existence, then we go, well, why should I cultivate compassion for them? Because we think, oh, if something doesn't have inherent existence, then it doesn't exist at all, which is a misconception on our part. So this Bodhisattva has the ability to know that sentient beings lack inherent existence, but their compassion is so strong that they don't abandon sentient beings. And in fact, knowing that sentient beings lack inherent existence give those bodhisattvas much more confidence in their ability to be of benefit, because if sentient beings were truly existent, it would be impossible to benefit them because they would be permanent and you couldn't do anything. So this, the bodhisattva's ability to combine, you know, the realizations of wisdom and compassion so that they're mutually enhancing is very, very skillful. They can do this. It's quite amazing. Okay, so in Bodhisattva grounds, Bodhisattva Bhumi Bai, who wrote Bodhisattva Bhumi? Who wrote the text Bodhisattva Bhumi? Asanga. Okay. So he described two types of skillful means. Okay, so the first kind is called accomplishing all the qualities of a Buddha within themselves. Okay, so this kind of skillful means you're working hard to develop all the qualities of a Buddha within your own mind. Okay, so here what bodhisattvas do is they practice looking upon all sentient beings with compassion. They practice knowing the ultimate nature of phenomena. They practice desiring the exalted wisdom of unsurpassed enlightenment. They practice not abandoning samsara due to looking upon all sentient beings with compassion. So they may abandon their own samsara, but they're not abandoning sentient beings in samsara because they look upon them with compassion. Yeah, they practice taking rebirth in samsaric realms with a mind of wisdom and compassion, which gives them tremendous ability to be a benefit. And they practice spurring or increasing their enthusiasm due to their desire to attain full awakening. Now, does these sound like qualities that it would be good for you to develop? Sounds like good qualities, doesn't it? Yeah, do you think you can kind of think about these qualities and develop them a little bit at your own level? Yeah. Okay. So even though here, this is what, you know, the seventh grounder has developed the ability to, you know, we can see, oh, I can also kind of improve in that way and go in that direction. Okay. And then the second group of skillful means is called ripening all other living beings. So ripening sentient beings is how you make them receptive to the Dharma. And so here bodhisattvas cultivate the ability to teach sentient beings how to transform small actions into great virtue. Can you teach? Yeah? Sound like something you can do a little bit? Yeah? You know something about karma. You can encourage others how to transform a small action to something great. They cause living beings to accomplish the great roots of virtue without hardship. So they teach them about rejoicing. They teach them, you know, about developing fortitude so they can, you know, create great roots of virtue. They cultivate the ability to eliminate anger in those who dislike the Buddhist doctrine. Yeah, so people who kind of just throw the Buddhism out and say it's all hogwash, and they're angry about it, you have the ability to talk to them and change their mind and ripen their mind. They practice encouraging those with a neutral attitude to enter into the Buddha's doctrine. So people who are just, you know, they encourage and they can actually help those people develop their interest in the Dharma. They ripen the mental continuum of those who have entered into the doctrine. So, you know, those of us who have, you know, even our teensy little bit of receptivity to the Dharma, then they teach us, and they teach us ways to increase our virtue and to purify our mind so that our mind becomes more and more receptive to the teachings. And they cause those who are ripened to attain liberation. So, you know, as sentient means minds get riper and riper and more receptive, then these bodhisattvas teach them exactly what it is that they need to meditate on in order to become a fully awakened Buddha. Okay, so they're skillful means in being able to develop in themselves the quality of the Buddha and to ripen the minds of others is really fantastic. Yeah, wouldn't you like to be able to do some of those things? Yeah, it doesn't sound so impossible. I mean, it sounds like something that you could do that's going to take some work, but it sounds like something would be good to be able to do.
Okay. Can it say the rejoicing part of the 35 Buddhas that whatever merit I've created by fully ripening sentient beings?
Yeah.
We have done this before in some form or another.
Yeah. Or even now, you know, you go into Spokane and teach a meditation class, you're ripening sentient beings' minds. You know, people who would never have even considered learning meditation, now they're learning it. And they're realizing the benefit. Okay. So we're doing that in our own little ways. Okay, and then the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the seventh ground. So there is a mode of taking fruitional rebirth because having taken rebirth as the lord of the land of controlling others' emanations, that's one of the six desire realm gods. Okay, one furthers the welfare of sentient beings. So it's like being born, you know, you have a higher status, you meet more people, you have the ability to influence more people. So in that way, Nagarjuna's precious garland says, the seventh is the gone afar, because the number of good qualities has increased moment by moment. The number of good qualities has increased. Okay, so we understand that. So they've gone afar. Yeah, moment by moment, the bodhisattva can enter into the equipoise of cessation. So they've gone afar because they can do that too. Through the maturation of these qualities, the bodhisattva becomes a master of the gods in the land of control over others' emanations. He or she becomes a great leader of teachers because of directly realizing the Four Noble Truths. Okay? So you become a great leader of teachers. That would be nice, wouldn't it? You know, if you could be the teacher of other people who are going to go out and teach. Yeah? Then you can, again, your ability to benefit has so many more ripple effects. So there is a reason for calling this ground the gone afar, because in dependence upon cultivating the path for a long time, there is an uninterrupted relationship between the two, which means you go from one to the other, you know, smoothly. So the two, one is called the final path having signs and having exertion, which means the end of the seventh ground. And and the path of soul passage, which means the beginning of the eighth ground, because there you are beginning the last of the three countless great eons that you need to go through to become enlightened. Okay, so remember when we're counting three countless great eons, one is the is path of accumulation, path of preparation. Another is first bhumi to seventh bhumi. And now, you know, you're making this transition from the seventh bhumi to the eighth bhumi, and from the eighth, ninth, and tenth bhumis, the pure grounds, so-called, because you're free or pure of the afflictive obscurations, then that's your last countless great eon. So you're in this transition point. So it's a very important transition, because you're going from somebody who has afflictive obscurations to somebody who doesn't. Yeah? So, Maitreya's ornament for the Mahayana Sutras says, because it is related with the path of soul passage, that means the eighth bhumi, this ground is asserted as the ground of the gone afar. So you're making that transition, you're really going far. And Nagarjuna's praise of the element of quality says, since the bodhisattvas, this is a different translation than you have in your text, since the bodhisattva's web of brilliant light with its display reaches every point in their surroundings, and since they have crossed cyclic existence's swampy ocean, they are called the ones who reach far. Mm-hmm. So they've gone afar, because at the end of the seventh bhumi, when you're about to enter the eighth bhumi, you are crossing over the ocean of cyclic existence to liberation. Okay, so we will pause there and continue next week. Thank you.
Is the sign of text Bodhisattva Bhumi's translated in English?
Not that I know of. No, I don't think a Sangha's Bodhisattva Bhumi is translated into English. These last few days I've been emailing a friend of mine in Israel who has been translating a Sangha's Shravaka Bhumi. And I was asking for his doctoral, dissertation. And I was asking him to do a little part in the Bodhisattva Bhumi for me. And he says he really wants to he'd love to, he's doing this little part, but he'd love to translate the whole text because he knows Sanskrit. Yeah, but he needs a benefactor or a sponsor to help him do that, because he has a family to take care of. Yeah? So, may a sponsor come to help him translate Bodhisattva Bhumi into English from Sanskrit. Because it's a very, very important text.
And could you describe a little bit about it?
The Bodhisattva Bhumi goes through all the Bodhisattva practices. It goes into what you do in all these different bhumis, all the practices of a Bodhisattva, in depth, Yeah. So, we've studied the six far-reaching practices, but it goes really in depth into all of those, and actually the whole 10. And how to develop bodhicitta, and it's just all about the bodhisattva path.
Are there Tibetan commentaries on it?
The Tibetan commentaries are mostly texts like the Lam Rim, which have drawn extensively from Asanga, and just been written up to explain what Asanga was saying. Okay.